Today's show is sponsored by Howl.fm, which, as you know, it's like Netflix for podcasts, and Howl Premium subscribers now have access to the first 13 seasons of Never Not Funny Archives, the award-winning podcast hosted by Jimmy Pardo. So yeah, that's 386 extra episodes, totaling over 500 hours of Never Not Funny. That is not fair, you guys. That is going to waste a lot of my time. If you haven't signed up for Howl yet, you can use code CRACKED when you check out on howl.fm to get a month of Howl Premium for free. And after your full month free trial, it's only $4.99 a month. That's a great price. So that's howl.fm and use promo code CRACKED for a 1 month free trial of Howl Premium. When they got everybody on their hands and knees. Ain't gon' leave until they find them kids. Now Dirty Bill Clinton fronted me some weight. Told me keep two, bring him back eight. And I only brought him five and stuck his ass for three. Do you think that clamp of the sickest goons on me? See, Martell Home, that's my claim to fame. It's where I learned my slickest tricks in the dope, the gang. Like my favorite, I call it Lemon Head Delight. When you lick off all the yellow and you sell the white. Right. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien, I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked. And this week, we're listening to Dirty South by Goody Mob off their 1996 album Soul Food. I'm playing it because of the part you just heard about Lemonhead Delight, where you lick off all the yellow and sell the white, which is appropriate because this week we're talking about The Simpsons. Get it? Because they're yellow. Yeah, the way I pick music for this podcast is basically cycling through songs I've added to a playlist I cleverly titled For Podcast and seeing if anything jumps out at me as appropriate. And yeah, Shuffle kept bringing me to songs that I love that made reference to people being yellow. And I was like, you know, hey, if you say so, Ghost of Steve Jobs. And then it was this morning, and I still hadn't come up with a better theme for the music. So I was like, The Simpsons do have yellow heads. We even make reference to it in the conversation, and Dirty South is an overlooked classic. And so here we are. You're welcome. Anyways, we're talking about The Simpsons with Simpsons writers Mike Reese and Jeff Martin because we recently ran an episode of the show After Hours that Dan O'Brien and I co-created. And the episode was written by Simpsons super fan, occasional podcast co-host Michael Swaim. And the episode covered some fun theories about the show. The universe is about as intricately detailed and fleshed out as any fictional universe in existence. And After Hours is a show where we get to interact and play with fictional universes. So natural fit, sort of shocking, took us this long to write a Simpsons episode. The episode talked about the idea that the Simpsons represent the different psychological mechanisms in the Freudian model of psychology. Bart's the id, Lisa is the ego, Marge, I think, is the superego, Homer, the base lizard brain, and so forth. We talk about a theory that it's a universe of ultra violence. We've made a similar argument about the Tarantino universe. Tarantino movies have characters from one movie related to characters in others. And that theory goes that, you know, basically Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs take place in an alternate timeline where a team of Jewish badasses did shoot Hitler's face to pieces in a movie theater at the end of World War II. Anyways, in this episode, we present a similar theory about The Simpsons with the derivation happening when Steamboat Willie was invented and was a violent, itchy and scratchy cartoon instead of the first Mickey Mouse. Also, one really compelling theory that everyone in Springfield are mentally unbalanced clones. In one episode where the characters go to Shelbyville, the neighboring town that they're competitive with in Springfield, we see that there are basically cloned versions of the people from Springfield in Shelbyville. So the idea is basically Shelbyville has the failed clones of the people from Springfield, or vice versa. Maybe Springfield's the failed clones. Mind blown. And yeah, we see different characters killed all the time and return good as new. See previous ultra-violent society theory. So the clone theory is that they're all being swapped out for clones. Anyways, the episode went up, was extremely popular and successful. The end, we're the best. So a few weeks later, Michael got an email from Simpsons writer and once showrunner Mike Reese. And rather than saying, hey, this is a cease and desist, stop using our intellectual property for your stupid fan theories, he said he liked the episode and is a fan of Cracked. So after having a 3-hour-long orgasm, Michael invited him onto the podcast so we could sit down with him in person and have 3-hour-long orgasms while making eye contact with him. No, we knew that would be creepy, so we instead decided to have a podcast. Mike also volunteered to bring along Jeff Martin, writer of Daniel O'Brien's favorite episode of The Simpsons, about Homer forming a barbershop quartet, sort of a fun riff on the Beatles and pop music history. So the five of us sat down together at the Earwolf Studios and had a great conversation about all sorts of things. Mike Reese writes puzzles for NPR as a side job, and I think that's a good way to view The Simpsons itself, as a bunch of sort of intricately designed puzzles, not necessarily to be solved, but it's fun to puzzle over them, I guess, or at least that's how we thought of it. You'll hear that he is pretty clear that we are in fact wrong about everything and how we thought about the Simpsons universe. A few things that we rattle off without giving much context, well, just nerding out. We talk about George Meyer a couple times, who you might remember from a previous episode of this podcast about badasses you've never heard of. Michael mentioned him as one of his badasses. He's a Simpsons writer Michael brought up, because basically when a Simpsons writer writes an episode and someone tells them they like it and, you know, start quoting their favorite jokes from the episode, the writers are always forced to admit that those were jokes that George Meyer wrote. He's just the guy behind the guy. The Simpsons executive producer at the time called him the best comedy writer in Hollywood. Mike once told a story about how they were trying to come up with a name for a theme restaurant Mo was opening, and they were all coming up with stuff like, you know, TGI Thursdays and, you know, lame riffs on theme restaurants. And George suggested the Texas Cheesecake Depository with a JFK assassination theme. Anyways, he's just mentioned in passing, but that's who George is when that name comes up. Al is Al Jean, Mike's writing partner. There's a great anecdote Mike has about Al. I think I'm getting the subjects of these anecdotes right. He said that he pitched a joke where Abe Simpson, Grandpa Simpson, tells someone in the retirement home to change the channel, and they say, "Who died and made you boss of TV or whatever?" And Abe says, "Fred," and pan over, and there's a guy named Fred being wheeled out of the room. And Al Jean said to the writer's assistant, "Hey, actually, could you pull episode 11 of season 4, go to page 17? And there was that joke. So Al Jean has just an encyclopedic knowledge of every joke that's ever been written on The Simpsons. He's been involved in writing a lot of them. So that's who Al Jean is. They talk about James L. Brooks. They might call him Jim, I forget. But that's something underrated, or at least that I'd underrated about the creation of The Simpsons. So James L. Brooks is the Academy Award-winning writer and director of Terms of Endearment, As Good as It Gets, Emmy Award-winning creator of The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Taxi. And they bring him up in reference to one of the most poignant and heartbreaking moments in the history of the show. Lisa is in love with her substitute teacher and is heartbroken when he's leaving town. So she goes to the train station as he's leaving and tells him that she doesn't think she can go on without him. And he tells her that no matter where she is or what's happening, she needs to remember one thing and she'll be okay. And he hands her a note and gets on the train. And as the train pulls away, she opens it. And if you don't know what it says, you'll hear, I guess. But while I was researching this podcast, I realized how underrated it was that James L. Brooks co-created the show and was there from day one, sort of guarding the writers and creative process from studio notes. And they bring that up, but you know, having somebody with that much clout and who's that much of a confirmed genius is just hugely important. That's how you get a show that's so intricately detailed and brilliantly imagined, where the writers just get to sit around and think about jokes. So we'll talk about that. Otherwise, I think that's mostly it. There's a bunch of references to specific episodes and jokes that you will either get or you won't, but it moves pretty fast, so you won't be bored if you don't get them. This episode is probably for Simpsons fans, although maybe not. It's also interesting as a study in the difference between how fans view something they consume and love versus how it's viewed by the people who made it. So anyways, yeah, I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Fucking around with hoes, busting nuts in their mouth, kicking that same southern slang, looking for love off in your jaw. How to get you hyper, reefer makes you calm, cigarettes give you cancer, rules make you dumb. What you niggas know about the nerd sound? See, never did I think when I got grown that some peewee sacks have been untook this town. See, life's a bitch, then you figure out why you really got dropped in the dirty side. See,
we're joined in studio by Michael Swaim and Daniel O'Brien,
which howdy.
Is a rare treat to have these two together, half of After Hours.
Go Team Venture.
If I had Daniel and Michael talking about The Simpsons in an episode, that would be enough. And so that's what we're going to do, just talk between the three of us. No, we are incredibly lucky to be joined by Mike Reese and Jeff Martin, who are writers and producers of The Simpsons and some of our favorite episodes. So we get to talk Simpsons with them.
Yes, and Dan and I will struggle to stifle.
It's really kind of Jack and Cracked to let the audience indulge Michael and I as we live out a childhood dream.
Yeah, this is basically what we had always hoped After Hours would become.
Yeah.
It's just, you guys replace our friends, and then that can be on and off camera. No.
So Mike reached out to us after we had a recent episode that Michael wrote.
Yeah, this actually came out of Mike contacted us after seeing the recent After Hours Simpsons episode and basically kindly told me that every point we made was absolute crap and there was nothing to them. And we were like, we got to get this on the air.
It was so deeply researched and so very wrong.
And I think that could be Crack's masthead if we ever go back to printing, I guess, a newspaper edition. Right. And I think in the vein of this episode, I actually haven't run this by Dan and Jack, the creators. Is it okay if I ruin After Hours? Like, can I...
Yeah, that's fine.
Destroy that right now? Okay, so something I want to tip about After Hours that I think most fans eventually catch on to is, we know, or what we love to do. What we love to do is look at scatter plots of data for things that interest us and basically interpolate theories that aren't there. And it's always funny to me that every once in a while we'll get a really long, heartfelt comment from someone saying, the works of Joss Whedon aren't interconnected. He just writes about similar themes because, as an artist, he's interested in those themes. I'm like, that's boring, though.
Well, it's just rare that we get confronted by the actual creator of a thing.
Exactly.
To tell us wrong. I had a similar situation at a party. A friend of mine introduced me to a friend of his, and we were talking about Star Wars, and I said, I've read this interesting theory that R2-D2 is a boy droid based on the way he's shaped, it's very phallic shape, and BB-8 from the new Star Wars is a girl droid. It's much curvier, and there's like research to back this up. And the guy that we were talking to was like, oh, that's interesting. BB-8's a boy. And I go, well, what's your theory? I asked J.J. Abrams, and he told me BB-8's a boy. Like, but mine's more fun. It's about shapes.
So we're thrilled.
Yeah.
To have our theories actually shot down in person.
Yeah. But just to give people some context, Mike, I've heard you talk a couple times about episode 6, which you were involved with, which...
What is episode 6?
I think it was episode 6.
I can't believe I'm lost. What was it about?
Season 1, episode 6?
Oh, yeah.
Just how much of The Simpsons came from you guys just making stuff up off the cuff?
Yes. I mean, we wrote that in 3 days, just sitting in a room. It was... We just talked it through and put it on. It was nobody's favorite episode, and it was something we did the first season we haven't done since, which is we made it, we put it on the air, and then we changed it. We re-edited it and put some new jokes in, and the rerun was different than the original. It was always kind of a mess, but that's the episode that introduced Chief Wiggum and Eddie and Lou and Jimbo Dolphin Kearney and Nelson and Apu. You know, we weren't creating universes. They all came in with one line. We didn't think we'd use them again.
Wait, In that episode, I think Eddie and Lou's voices were even switched, right?
It may be. Yeah. And that, if he's in that episode, Smithers is black. I mean, Smithers was black the first season.
Yeah, it was very progressive to make Smithers black, and then very troubling that you took it back, I thought.
Jimbo and Dolph's voices were switched at some point.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, they were.
I'm sure they did.
Was there a specific point where you realized, hey, the Simpsons thing is taking off, we should have a board that has the universe? Like, did you start keeping track at
right.
some point?
Or one was of my, always- sorry. Yeah, one of the seminal posters of my childhood is, you know, 850 Simpsons characters right. and learning them like the periodic table of elements when I should have been learning that.
And I'm sure you know it better. It hangs in our office.
Exactly.
And two-thirds of my we all look at it and go, who's that? Who are these people?
Yes.
What are they doing? And every once in a while, it's pretty good. We have, if people can visualize this poster of every character that's been on the show.
Right.
Sometimes when we need an episode idea, we'll go, hey, that guy never met that guy.
Oh, I have always wondered about that.
Yes.
Shows with weird combinations of characters who haven't gone on an adventure together has got to be an endless source of material. But you said you didn't go in creating universes or with that
no.
in mind. And that's sort of what I want to, in large part, talk about is this crazy universe that's been built just by incrementally making any joke probably that you wanted to at the time, right? Mm-hmm. Not trying mm-hmm. to create a universe. And it brings me to one of my weirder theories, which is, do you remember the episode? It's about stealing cable, and they and Marge getting drunk. Is this the Jeff Martin episode I'm talking
about?
No,
but this one we basically, very early after I joined the show, like four of us basically wrote that one, you and me and George and Al. We were trying to think of Troy McClure movie titles, and I came up with one, Here Comes the Coast Guard, and that went in. And I was at Simpsons Land at Universal Studios.
Oh, wow.
And they have, you know, Springfield recreated the right. Aztec Theater, and one of the movies playing at it was Here Comes the Coast Guard.
Great.
And you just think, jeez, it's just insane.
Yeah.
A joke. You know, is now in a theme park.
Right.
Oh. Whenever I hear
5 minutes were suddenly they're recreating it. In
yeah, Cletus was a little league coach of mine.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He was not. It's no big deal. I mean, it's not even a joke. It's just a name.
Right.
Yeah. But and he wasn't a hillbilly. He was a plumber.
And I think by season 25, his kids are all singing in a band, and they have a whole episode around them. Yeah. Things grow.
I've told this story too much because you're not even my only podcast today. And, it's true. But Apu, he was not intended to be a character. He had one line. He was called Clerk. Mm-hmm. He had one line, 35 cents, please. And I wrote in the script, because we were writing in the room, I said, he is not an Indian. Because I said, that is a comedy cliche.
I see, yeah.
And we get to the table reading. We come up on the clerk's line, and Hank Azaria goes, 35 cents, please. And it got this giant laugh, and suddenly Apu was an Indian. And suddenly I learned that Hank Azaria doesn't read stage directions.
Yeah, racism.
I will say just a little insider piece. Another name thing is Apu's last name, Nahasapi Mapetalon.
Sure.
It was a guy I was in junior high with who was in my gym class. And his name was extreme. His entire name was extremely similar to Apu's whole last name. And I remembered him because the gym coach would go down the line, take and roll. And he'd go Martin McCoy. And he'd get to this guy and he'd go, there's my buddy.
All right. Well, just so this nominally has some structure, though, I am going to spit out this theory and let you shoot it down. In that episode, Homer has a vision of his family driving to hell and another family driving to heaven. That family is this random family of four that represents the ideal family. Mr. Burns loves them at the party. They come first with the Jell-O. They get in the car. They drive to heaven. Several episodes later, at the Marvin Monroe therapy clinic, that family is in the waiting room fighting.
Ah.
Then a few episodes after that, you see just the dad alone in Moe's.
Holy cow.
So wow. I don't understand how it can't be intentional that we witness this marriage fall apart in the background. But it must just be nothing, right? It's nothing.
Completely random.
Life is nothing.
they were available character designs.
Yeah. You don't want to.
I feel like just
anonymous family.
And is that true? So, guy in fishing hat with long straight beard.
Oh, well, that's
these
George
are
Meyer,
extras.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Is he? He's. I think he is drawn to look like George Meyer, but they eventually just become models that you'll pull from for a crowd scene, right?
Absolutely. The more than the writers or people we know, it's the animators stuck themselves in the first season, and mm-hmm. they've just become rotating characters. People who've left the show years ago are still popping up in crowds.
Oh, I see. So the extras we see, some are
some
animators.
Some are the animators. That's whenever awesome. You see the itchy and scratchy writers, it's always the current Simpsons writing staff.
Gotcha.
And the itchy and scratchy writers work in this terrible shithole of an office, right, yeah. and that's our office.
Nice.
I like just watching the reaction in the room while Michael is doing a very long theory, and you guys are shaking your heads. This podcast is tailor-made for a Simpsons joke of Michael talking, and then suddenly we hear footsteps, door slam, car start.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's like a playing Beatles records backwards yeah. level of... Right.
Yeah, I won't get to what I thought the meaning was of a sequence of three still images on the TV in Moe's Tavern in episode one.
What? What you're talking about, that family, I know who you're talking about because it's the Gammels. We named them after friends of ours who wound up working on the show. It was another crazier theory, which is we needed a name for the professor, and Jake Hogan, one of the writers, says, oh, I got this friend, John Frink.
Yeah.
So John Frink was a character, and then 15 years later, he became a writer
on
the show.
Right, yeah,
so,
of course, you see his credit. Yeah.
And somebody said, are your characters coming to life?
Are they just you? Or, which
are there any spite names? Like someone who's like, oh, I had this basketball coach that I hated. Fuck you! You're Nelson Muntz now. You're this bully that we don't care for.
Or Muntz is, it all just is like a great
friends who eventually get hired
name for someone you hate. Yeah.
No, I can't think. I mean, because you get in trouble for that kind of thing. Sure. I remember you named the character Samantha. Samantha Stan.
Oh, well, it was my little daughter at the time who I was never seeing because I was in the Simpsons writers room all day. And it's not even interesting, but I think actually Jake Hogan named the character Samantha, but I thought, hey, I'll score some points. So I say, hey, there's a character named Samantha.
I couldn't be here for your birthday, but yeah, I named this character after you.
here's some money.
Well,
anyway, and then on the episode.
You can eat tonight. You're welcome.
On the episode, I think, sir. She has a little romance with Milhouse, and like her father yells at her, like, Samantha! Yeah. And my daughter she was tiny. She was like three, four, got very upset.
Oh, the TV man is mad at me.
So, yeah, it's an unhappy story.
Well, pulling out selectively the happy part of the slew of things you guys just said, Simpsons has been so driven and driven in culture and been defined by such a layered visual sensibility.
Right.
Like, I think
the reason that we've kidnapped you to bombard you with theories for 90 minutes, you guys sort of trained
90
us.
90 minutes?
Yep.
Jesus Christ.
You guys sort of trained us in the brilliant writing of the show. Like, the lessons that I took as a person interested in comedy was leave no comedic stone unturned, because I'm looking at Simpsons and you're not doing an establishing shot that is like, we're at the school now. You're doing, we're at the school now. Here are three jokes in the sign outside of it, or we're panning through a house. Here are some jokes hidden beneath the floorboards. And I thought, okay, good. They're hiding something everywhere. I bet they're hiding even more.
Yeah,
and that's where these fan theories sort of come from. That
Between you guys and the Marx Brothers, you taught me 80% of comedy, or at least like the mode of comedy in which I write comes from The Simpsons.
Oh, wow.
And I don't mean that to aggrandize you. It's like objectively accurate. But I was wondering, because of this layered visual style, you were talking about how the animators do have license to choose what stuff looks like. How much was that an aspect of collaborating with the animators, or how much do the scripts read like opening scene, bullet point of eight visual jokes that are in the shot, and then the dialogue, you know?
We write the visual jokes. We write the sign jokes, hours and hours writing these sign jokes. They just execute them. They execute them, but they execute them always as well as we visualize them or better.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always said I would rather, on The Simpsons, I'd rather have a lousy script with the good director doing it than a great script with, you know, a passable director. They can just elevate the material, and they do, you know, they are directors. They direct the actors. They direct the acting and that kind of thing and the timing of everything. But almost always the actual, anything you'd say, that's a joke, we wrote it.
Gotcha.
Mike saying it takes hours and hours, it's like the thing I always want to stress to people is we did the show without any network interference at all. Mm-hmm. And I've just thought a million times, you could have never done The Simpsons. It couldn't have happened done the way a show usually is, where you're running ideas by and bouncing it by the executives and all that. And it's not that everything you get back from them is stupid. It just takes time.
Sure.
Right.
It just takes time.
So much
like
energy.
About a third of your time. I got to say, man, we went in and like 12 hours we're in there and the whole time. If they go in an arcade, you'll have 10 funny video games to walk by because we had the time to think of
it's
them.
It's fun to brainstorm in the room. Yeah.
Time waster.
That's what you mean by sign jokes, right? Like jokes that are in the background on the signs.
Right.
Right. Yeah,
we call them pause jokes, I think, because they've gotten so long and involved people will freeze frame to read the article or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
And I'll tell you something interesting, which is since the show went to high def, whatever, 5 or 6 years ago, we have to do more of that. Like we did a scene where Lisa's in the library and she's sitting there, and in the old days they would just be blank books or something. You'd put a squiggle and that was the title. But it's high def, it's a bigger screen. So we had to write every
35
title.
30
book titles for something that would be on for a second. She's not going back to the library.
I saw a 8-minute YouTube video just barely adequately explaining a joke on Futurama where there's two books on a shelf called N and not N. And if you watch someone explaining the joke to you, you have to like learn calculus in the moment. It's just ridiculous the amount of effort that goes into them.
Mike, I think I heard you say that like you were watching an episode and saw an equation go by Homer's head like realized was wrong like 20 years on.
Give me 90 seconds to tell this story. It's in 3D Homer in a Halloween show. Homer's in 3D and an equation goes by in the background. 1742 to the 12th plus 1814 to the 12th equals 1945 to the 12th. And I remember I saw that and I go, oh, pretty interesting. And 5 years later, I suddenly woke up. I go, that equation can't be correct. It violates Fermat's last theorem. I know you caught that. A to the n plus b to the n cannot equal c to the n for anything, any power of n over 2.
And to your credit, you pulled that episode and forbade it from the air.
It'll never show again. But so I called David Cohen, who wrote the episode, and I said, that equation in your show is wrong. And he goes, I know. That's how he talks. I know that's the joke. and he said, I wrote a program to generate these triples that, although they are incorrect, they are correct to the first 30 places. So it would fool a computer.
Get it?
He said it generated infinite triples, but I thought that was the funniest one.
Oh my goodness.
I'll give you a little behind the scenes thing. I'm just remembering this second was for a little tiny joke that was like very esoteric where only like the 1%, only your comic book guy would get it.
Yeah.
The joke arose in the room that would actually bring those viewers to orgasm. You remember this? So jokes like, something like one of the members of the baseball team Mr. Burns wanted was Jim Creighton, was the right fielder. And it turns out Swartzwelder wrote it, and he's the only one who knew this. Jim Creighton, like the first ball player who ever achieved any fame in America for being good at baseball. And he died during the Civil War and all that. But it's on the board is Jim Creighton.
Yeah.
And from making the joke that this is bringing these guys to sexual climax. All right. And after a while, when someone would pitch a joke like that, the shorthand for it simply became splort. Splort was shorthand for obsessive viewers.
The nerds will love this.
We'll love that one.
There's a lot of great gems buried in Mr. Burns stuff that requires research that I feel like must have been so much fun for you guys.
Knowledge of the Civil War era.
Answering the phone, ahoy, hoy, like that drove me to research. And that's like
Alexander
first
Graham
way
Bell.
People answer.
No, Alexander Graham Bell suggested that would be, that's how, and Thomas Edison said, how about hello?
Right.
and that one caught on.
I thought you'd be a human being for once.
And of course, I mean, Simpsons, we started writing it in 88, but it was pre-internet, and we just had, you remember this? We had a big one-volume encyclopedia on the desk. Uh-huh. That was where we got all our info. What was sort of neat with The Simpsons was, you know, when we had, what did we have, like 8 writers the first couple of seasons, every one of us knew a lot about one thing.
Yeah.
We had a guy who knew a lot of science, and someone knew a lot of history. Someone knew a lot of baseball. Jeff knows a lot of baseball, everything about show business.
Well, I do remember the episode where Sideshow Bob sings from HMS Pinafore at the end, and it was like, okay, well, I guess we need to send an intern out to, like, you know, buy probably a vinyl record to see what the
wax cylinder.
Yeah, no, I guess they had CDs, but anyway, it was pre-internet, for crying out loud. It was that long ago.
Speaking of crazy knowledge and musical theater, this is will also segue into my fan theory. And Jeff, this is an episode you wrote, Homer's Barbershop Quartet.
Yes,
I'm in fifth or sixth grade at the time, and a musical theater kid, huge Beatles fan, huge Simpsons fan.
Yeah.
Very few things intersect for me perfectly, and that episode did, and it really, watched it so many times, and there was a throwaway joke in it when Skinner's like, oh, my, like, finds his prisoner helmet at the flea market.
Yes.
And his number was 24601, and, like, my sixth grade brain lights up. It's like, Les Mis,
sport.
That's Jean Valjean. Hooray. sport, that's right. And years later, Principal and the Pauper is Seymour Skinner reveals to have a dual identity, like he stole someone's identity. And adult Daniel splurting is like, are they telegraphing that? Because Jean Valjean assumed a new identity and Skinner, like, are they trying to tell me something? You're going to tell me right now that you're not, that there's
They're
no
connection.
They're
trying to tell you you're their favorite.
No, the first part of that, the Jean Valjean is, yes, a little tip of the hat to theater nerds like me.
And the second one is based on The Return of Martin Guerre, even more obscure. It's
goodness.
I don't even know what that started off. It's an old movie, and it was remade a couple of times, but it might have been a novel, but that's stolen from Return of Martin Guerre.
I think they regretted it by the end of that episode. Gee, do we really want to make Skinner a different person?
Oh, they hated it.
At the end of the episode, I think they say, I didn't write on this one, I think they say something like, you know, yes, let's never speak of this again.
Under pain of torture. And that model has actually been used in later episodes, I think, or that sort of set a precedent for... Yeah, there's been a few episodes. There's an episode where Kang says in time, it's an alien abduction episode, and at the end he goes, we'll return you to Earth, and in time your memories of all of this will fade, and then he does the shifty eyes. And I remember just losing it at that joke. I thought it was so funny.
Which joke?
The under pain of torture joke. I don't mind a comedic world breaking, but as we referenced in the After Hours episode, that has been, or the Principal and the Pauper is a much talked about episode among the writers. And I was wondering where you guys land on, or if you'd speak to the sort of, the way I look at it is it's been a trend of Simpsons going from really humanistic, like family-based stories to it's season 13 and we're so familiar with the characters that we need to just Rolodex. Like there's sort of more of a rip from the headlines or a timeliness vibe, I would say, these days. And you can argue if you'd like.
Wrong again.
Go for it. You can rebut. But I mean, like, I feel like nowadays a Simpsons episode is much more likely to touch on something where I'm like, oh yeah, I just heard about that social trend and they've found a way to comment on it in a really interesting way. Whereas I think it started with one foot very much in the All in the Family world, and it felt more beholden to be like, what are the family dynamics? And now we have the whole town, and we're just playing the town. Was that a choice? Like, do the writers talk about what eras they like? Or
It was forced on us by the fact that we'd used up all the good stories. I think by season, you can pick a year, season 6, season 8, every kind of normal, relatable, eternal story you could do with The Simpsons, we'd done it. Every single character had an episode where they had a crush on someone that was not reciprocated. Every character had an episode where someone had a crush on them, and they did not reciprocate it.
I think they've all faced death or mortality in some
all
way.
Faced that. I mean, there was a point, I think, around season 10 where every single member of The Simpsons family has been in jail.
That's funny
and
to think about.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, and we could have stopped the show if you just want us to represent family dynamics. We've told them all, and we never do kind of fresh topical stories because it takes us a year to make a show, and it won't be topical anymore. We'll let South Park do that. But
sure,
big trends, things happening in society. Yeah, that's where we get a lot of ideas.
And that's what's so interesting to me is Simpsons, by virtue of the fact that we as a society love you so much that we've asked you to pump it out eternally,
yeah,
you've been forced to mutate it and improvise and build structures on structures. Like the very fact that you have a joke in later seasons where Homer lists every job he's ever had can only exist in a universe where Simpsons has run that long. So you're actually getting to a point where bonus jokes are paying out. Well. That couldn't exist without your thing having already existed
right.
for so long.
One of my favorite jokes is Homer saying something like, "No, Marge, I'm a farmer. That's the kind of guy I am." This week.
This week. That's great.
But yeah, that Homer can be, you know, a Law and Order guy, and then exactly. the next week he's a hippie. Yeah.
Yes.
And declare this conformity factory closed. You know, goes into the school.
Hey folks, we're listening to Gold Lion by the Yeahs, I think is how it's said. A dope song about more yellow. I really am making that the theme of the music. A lot of dope music about yellow people and things, and in this case, animals. We've played another great song of theirs, Maps, which is up on our Spotify playlist. All of the music I play is on our Spotify playlist. Search Cracked Music on Spotify. Anyways, hope you enjoy this song and enjoy these words from our sponsors. Guys, this week we are sponsored by Harry's, and like I did with Mother's Day, let me warn you, Father's Day is this Sunday. Hint, hint. How about a gift that's cool, and that looks cool, feels special, and is something your dad will actually use every day of his life? That sounds good, right? So Harry's actually has a special edition Father's Day set with a matte black razor handle that is like really weighty. It feels high quality, really a cool razor handle. And it comes with a chrome razor stand that I have sitting right next to my sink. My wife is always like, get your stuff away from the sink. And no longer, she no longer complains about my razor being left by the sink because this chrome razor stand makes it look cool. They also give you in this incredible value of a set, shave gel, 3 replacement cartridges, and a travel cover for just $40. It's an amazing deal. And if that's too much or you're looking for something more simple for yourself, their regular shaving set starts at just $15. You really owe it to yourself to try this because $15 is like half as much as a refill on like Mach 3 cartridges cost. And we've worked out a deal so you can get $5 off either of those sets when you use the promo code CRACKED at checkout. So go to harrys.com, harrys.com, and use promo code CRACKED to save $5, get your dad something special for Father's Day, and to help the Cracked podcast. This week's episode is also brought to you by Loot Crate, the monthly subscription box service that sends you all sorts of awesome geek, gamer, pop culture gear. Basically, if you like stuff we talk about at Cracked, you're going to like the cool gear that comes in each crate. This is like if I could go around and take the shirts off of the backs of our editors and writers and, you know, the stuff off of their desk, like all the cool collectibles and toys that they bring to work, and put it in a box and send it to you every month, this is what that box would be. And a monthly subscription is less than $20 a month, which is incredible. And they guarantee over $40 of value in each box. So, you know, I'm no math whiz, but that is what industry experts might call a deal. And if you use promo code CRACKED at checkout, you can get $3 off your new subscription. Each month has a theme with curated items from the likes of Star Wars, Marvel, The Walking Dead, and with the sweltering summer heat and dire political landscape in mind, this month's theme is dystopia, with awesome gear from RoboCop, Terminator 2, The Matrix, BioShock Infinite, and Fallout 4. That's So appropriate. There is one catch, one and only catch. You only have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive that month's crate. And when that cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. You can't ever get any of the stuff in that month's crate because you can't get this stuff anywhere else. So go to lootcrate.com/cracked and enter code cracked to save $3 on your new subscription today and to help the Cracked podcast.
Of the malleability of Homer, do you guys feel like he's changed from being sort of all in the family-ish in the sense that he's one step behind society in terms of like bigotry or tolerance, and now he's average? This is my next theory. Homer started as Archie Bunker, like behind the times, like scared of John Waters being gay, etc. And now he actually
performing gay marriages. Yeah, that was the biggest.
Now he also he just represents the, I would say, more the societal norm now. Like he's on board with whatever the tenor of the times is.
Your previous question as to it starting, I do remember a sort of key moment was. Yeah, early on there was a real push for – no, they're a real family. You know, it's you're pushing for a couch gag one time where how about they run in and they hit the back wall and it falls, revealing it's a set. And Matt Groening was very, you know, no.
Oh, that's great.
They're real. It's like, okay, fine, you know. Then with the monorail episode, you'll recall Leonard Nimoy's in it. And toward the end, you know, he says, well, my work here is done. What do you mean? You didn't do anything, didn't I? And he actually beams out.
Yeah,
and I gotta say, in my memory, that's the first time where we've been like, oh, okay, we're really doing this?
We're just a cartoon,
right. Yeah.
Because it sure does open up a lot more jokes we can do.
Was the portentousness of that joke felt when you were writing it? Because, like,
somewhat.
I think
a little
okay.
bit. It creeps in. I can tell you, it's. Mm-hmm. We let that in, because it's Leonard Nimoy. I mean, we didn't discuss it, but we all sort of knew. He's not really a character on the show, and it's his background. And
yeah.
But I'm going to guess not too long after we did the baseball show, Homer at the Bat, mm-hmm. where the thing just went freaking crazy.
Yeah.
It went crazy. And
falls into a hole.
Ozzie Smith.
Nowhere.
Yeah. I did remember thinking at the time, okay, all right.
Here we go.
We've crossed the line.
We went for it, and I got to say, the cast hated it. We had the table reading of it, and – not all of them, but
right.
It was as angry as our cast has ever been. And they, you know, mm-hmm. They felt we were fooling with the brand and they didn't have many lines in it. But that was it. We opened the door.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite of that is the end of the Lord of the Flies parody episode where they're stuck on the island and they go, and in time, you know, and suddenly James Earl Jones sing, and in time the children were rescued by, let's say, Mo.
Yeah. And I got to say.
And just a nice reminder that, yeah. Look, it doesn't have to make sense.
Right.
It's not real.
There's certainly room in the world for both, and we've sort of done shows that are in both worlds, but I'm just wondering how explicitly you guys talked about it, because we'll actually talk about, when we're conceiving a series, like, what are the physical laws of this universe?
Well, now
are we going full cartoon, or is it a sitcom that obeys
physics? Now, based on this conversation, I'm saying we shouldn't do that. Like, this is the,
we
this
should
is
just
the,
do
the
what we
lesson
feel.
That I'm going to...
No, I don't agree with that. I didn't mean that.
But I think you're sort of... I'll give an example of me being the dope here, which is, for 10 years, Al Jean, my writing partner, said, let's do Mary Poppins. Simpsons hire Mary Poppins. And I said, no. If we do Mary Poppins... The next week, they're going to get a genie. And the week after that, there's going to be a groovy ghost in the house. So I held him off for years. And then
Ricky Gervais as a groovy ghost?
We finally wrote the show, and nobody's noticed this, which I'm glad of. But Mary Poppins comes in. She does no magic whatsoever. She just sort of hangs around and has an umbrella. There's nothing magical about her. And that was
other
me.
Than her entrance and exit. That's it.
Yeah, I guess she floats in. Even then, I'm thinking, well, I guess you could float in an
that's
umbrella.
Right. You could stop
sure
a monorail by hooking a big
you try
dog
first.
Yeah.
But you can't beam.
So that was it. And so there's no magic in the episode, thanks to me. And it came on, and it was like, why not? Why not? That's where I realized, oh, who cares? Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. let Mary Poppins be magic. But it's kind of funny to see she's really just the cleaning lady. Yeah. She has no magic to her at all.
But what I mean about the lesson of stopping is that I think you talk about these things and like, oh, why not? She can do it. And let's say, Mo, these are some of my favorite jokes that I'm now worried I wouldn't let us make in a writer's room because we argue so much about if something makes sense and
or if it's okay to happen.
Right, and I think sometimes that'll trump the joke. I think in the past it might have trumped the joke, and I think just the lesson to take away is like be a little bit more free with your writing or find some middle ground between
for me, the ultimate
rules and freedom.
Is the fairly recent episode where Homer leaves Moe's and they say, okay, let's all go into our suspended state of animation now.
I wrote that.
Yeah. That's like that. I love, fourth wall jokes. And I mean, 30 Rock, I feel like, also does that so well. And I certainly have a place in my heart for, heartfelt, grounded comedy. But cartoons, man, they're great. They're wonderful.
Also, they're a great example because writers, including me and a lot of people, we'll always go, okay, we could do one of those or do one of those a season. And then a movie like Deadpool comes out that just breaks reality every 45 seconds. Yeah. He's just constantly commenting on it. He's in and out. He's an actor. It's a movie. Works great.
Yeah.
You go, why are we holding off?
That's right. Yeah, the Austin Powers movies did great with that. Michael York will go, no, Austin, don't think about it too hard. Looks at the camera. You don't think about it too hard.
Yeah, the second Austin Powers where it's like, oh, it turned out she was a fembot. Yes, we've known all along, I'm afraid.
That's right.
A thing that you mentioned briefly that I think is probably not obvious to the listeners that each episode takes a year to animate?
It's the quickest it can go is 6 months from conception to air. It's generally about a year. There's a couple of episodes that took 5 years to do.
Wow.
Like the X-Files episode, which is sitting around for years. We just couldn't get that up and going.
We actually interviewed an animator from The Simpsons, and they said that the big difference between a Simpsons and South Park is walking. Walking is impossible to do, and you have to animate it, whereas South Park, they just kind of move them along, cut out stick figures. And I was like, wow, that seems like a lot of time to spend on walking. But then I thought back and one of my favorite Simpsons jokes ever is when Homer sees a poo having an affair.
Right.
And then backs out slowly and then backs all the way to his house. Yeah. And I was like, oh, walking is my favorite Simpsons joke.
Important. And there's these little miracles of animation performance. One of the bits that always gets me in Family Guy is actually the way Peter falls down.
Right.
Which only takes one frame.
Right.
Yeah. So I think animators definitely deserve a lot of credit. So that, just so our audience hears it, that's also why some of the jokes sometimes will be not lip-synced. Is that right? Because it takes so long for the show to be animated that you'll think of a better joke to swap in?
We'll do them on the backs of people's heads and kind of thing. Jim Brooks would pitch a lot of those. We'd show him an episode. We go, all right, this is airing on Sunday. He goes, have this guy say this and this and this. And I don't think he really gets animation. So we loop it in. It was like at the end of the Michael Jackson episode, everyone's waving goodbye. It's their backs. And Jim says, and then Lisa says, you're a credit to dementia. And it's like, okay. It's the back of her head. Okay. You're a credit to dementia. And the next day,
get her back in here.
It's mentioned in every review. Oh, this genius moment. You know? Nobody cares. Yeah.
I want to walk back something you said earlier, because when I hear that Simpsons takes 6 months to a year to come out, I always assumed it was animation, but you guys will spend 5 years just writing and conceiving of an episode too, like that X-Files episode.
It's sort of just selling. Sometimes it's selling the showrunner on the idea. Mm-hmm. Or when we did the X-Files, we first pitched it because it was this obscure little show. We said, we're going to help out the X-Files. We like it and give it some ink here. And it just sat there. And by the time it finally hit the air, the X-Files was much bigger than The Simpsons.
Wow.
And here we are 15 years later, and Simpsons is still on, and X-Files is back.
Right.
But they're much older.
Another random conspiracy theory. Do you have any reason to believe...
have you now? Or?
That Fox made Hank Hill have a signature sound that he makes when he's faced with something shocking. And that sound, in case you don't remember it, is... Whoa!
Oh.
I noticed that after not only dough, but woohoo, Marge's murmur. And I'm sure that's probably wasn't conscious also that just did, or was it conscious that every character has a sound they make?
More,
other than
it's
Lisa.
More like the Apu phenomenon.
Exactly.
If somebody does something funny.
But I do think, and I'm wondering if you feel it's at least plausible that there's executives out there in the world who think somehow
Hank
a cartoon
a
character needs to make a signature catch noise.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. I'll say show creators think that too.
Sure.
Oh, let's. I know if anyone remembers the PJs, Eddie Murphy's claymation show. They were there consciously sitting down. What's his dough going to be?
Oh,
and,
really?
Just, it was a funny night. They're just sitting around. Finally, they go, he'll say, and it was his thing.
And, of course, that show's still on the air.
And we did. Algie and I created a show called The Critic.
I can't believe we'll do another episode about The Critic.
We're gonna do it right now.
We're gonna go all day, man.
Are we talking about Achim now?
My vow was to not.
Achim came from John Lovitz.
That's John.
That was it. He made that noise. He would just do it, and so we put it in the show. But we needed a catchphrase for him, and I remembered something a bunch of performing midgets did at a county fair when I was a kid, and they said, Hachi Machi. And that's where that came from. And then years later, because we stuck Hachi Machi on The Critic, years later I'm watching a sketch show called The Whitest Kids You Know.
Oh, they're great.
It was great show. And in the middle, one of them says Hachi Machi, and I think back to the county fair when I was a kid, and it's the way when you watch TV and you've smoked a lot of pot and you think the TV's talking to you. Did they say Hachi Machi?
Yeah, to me?
Yeah.
Mike was telling me about Hachi Machi when I was 18.
Well, then I got to ask.
When I was a freshman in college.
Who coined and how did you land on I, Carumba, don't have a cowman and eat my shorts? Because they're like the lamest, most dated catchphrases for a 10-year-old boy to have. And he stuck with them. Like, I love how I, Carumba is now used almost ironically. You'll slip in like a I, Carumba as just a placeholder for Bart is going to say.
I feel like we kind of realized those weren't much because we did we did satirize them in like a Halloween episode where – but they're selling Simpsons T-shirts, and people are getting sick of it. And the one of Barty saying, "Hi, man."
One of my favorite grammar jokes of all time is, "Yes, let's all none of us have a cow."
The story of the creation of groundskeeper Willie is, sums up.
I haven't heard that.
What we're talking about.
Well, it hit us.
He ended up Scottish.
When we were saying they do something funny and we jump on it, I was about to say, like, for me, the big example of that was just when he came up the character. I don't know if it was when Bart fell down the well and Dan just, you know, did the voice. I won't try to do it. And it was just instantly, oh boy, are we going back here? Wait, you have a story?
I want to talk about it. I think it's the hardest they ever laughed in the Simpsons rewrite room. It's where their groundskeeper Willie and Sting are digging Bart out of the well. And at the end, I think it was Sting holds out. I don't think it's even in the show. Sting holds out his hand to groundskeeper Willie, and Willie won't shake it. And then he finally shakes it. It was just such a...
Like, shakes it with importance. Like,
right, exactly. All is forgiven. It's like, what is forgiven? You two haven't even met. That really killed me. Oh, my God. But
such a great joke.
Groundskeeper Willie, this is how it happened. He had two lines in an episode. At the start of the episode, he goes, "You'll be back." And at the end of this episode, he says, "I told you, you'll be back." And so... it was the last thing we were recording that day, and Dan Castellaneta says, "Who is this guy?" And Sam Simon says, "I don't know, give him an accent." And he goes, "You will be back." He did him Spanish. We go, no, that's racist. So he does him Scottish.
We already have Bumblebee Man for that.
Yeah. So he did it Scottish. You'll be back. I told you'll be back. And we
said, racist,
fine.
But it's white race. I
that
guess
was
that's
it.
Okay.
It was more, well, it's 6 o'clock. It's good enough. And we left, and that's a, it took... 30 seconds of thought to make groundskeeper Willie Scottish, and he is now a national hero in Scotland.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And in fact, the other thing is, in one episode, we said groundskeeper Willie's from Edinburgh, and another episode,
Aberdeen,
we said he's from Aberdeen and Glasgow. And so And we said he's from different towns because we don't care.
Right.
Those people in those towns care deeply. And when they play each other in soccer, a fight will always break out over where groundskeeper Willie is
really from.
I got to go to New York to record Sting for that episode.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And you know, very simple. He came, nice guy. And it did crack me up because I'd written that song, Cinderella Up Down the Well, the tune anyway, and I'm like, you know, teaching them the harmony and stuff like that. No. Yeah. And
look, Sting, is it Sting? Let me tell you something.
It just cracked me up because if you'll recall in the song, it's like Krusty is doing all the scatting. Like, yeah. Cinderella Up Down the Well, all the way down. And they have Sting, but Krusty is taking the spot. Right? Yeah. And I said Sting, well, I mean, you know, you can interject something there if you want. And he said, oh, it sounds like Krusty's got it, which was very cool.
Yeah, he gets the joke. That's good of Sting.
But in terms of something cracking someone up, the hardest I ever saw Conan tickled in the writer's room was, it was like barely a joke. It was the flashback remembering Homer as a boy soprano is like singing in a choir, singing No Holy Night.
Yeah, and his balls drop.
Well, right.
In real time.
Well, he's just going, you know, fall on your knees. Yeah. And it's very funny. And you have young grandpa in the audience, and he says, what a voice. Young Homer is going to make me a millionaire.
So it's just the phrase "young Homer."
Conan, he was just giggling for an hour that Grandpa called him Young Homer. Apparently, for the benefit of anyone watching this in flashback,
Master
to identify all the players. Yeah, right. he was just his guy red in the face, just going,
"Well, that's
Young Homer."
This is really cool because I feel like it sounds like, by letting it be sort of organic like that, and I know The Simpsons has sort of a core staff that evolves that do rewrites, but many, many writers have, like, trod the boards or whatever you want to say, right? So you sort of end up with this organic game of funny characters get picked up by other writers because they're funny characters and they want to use that character. Mm-hmm. So it's not too late for George Meyer lookalike to, like, become an actual character, right? If a writer used that character well enough, or the whatever that family had, the Gamels.
The Gamels.
I'm going to get
but,
the
you know,
Gamels
they don't even
show.
Look right. They're not on
I think
model.
It's been years since we've seen them even,
right.
Yeah.
There was one time, it was Mole Man. You know who, Hans Mole Man.
Yeah.
Oh, we're familiar.
Yeah, see, he appeared, you know, he looks like nothing else on The Simpsons. He appeared in one episode, and I remember, and it was very early on, and we were screening the episode, and Matt Groening saw Mole Man, and he said, freeze, and he's pointing to the character. He goes, that character will never appear on this show
what
again.
What is that thing?
Yeah. So we go, all right, Matt hates it. He's in every episode now.
Oh,
and we
nice.
Used to just call him Mole Man. Like, what is he? And then that became his name, Hans Moleman.
Didn't Matt Groening want to make Marge a rabbit?
Yes. Yes.
So, he's very like into realism.
That's funny. Yeah. And yet, I've heard the conspiracy theory thrown around a lot that there was talk of Krusty being revealed to be like Homer moonlighting as well.
Correct.
And if Matt was on board with that, you'd think like beaming out would be no big deal.
We had those ideas. I think Matt brought that to the table. We didn't know people would watch the show. We had no idea.
Right. Oh, and he's coming off Life as Hell, so he's like, bunnies. People want bunnies.
That's why Marge has tall hair. He said, in the final episode, she'll take her hair off, revealing big bunny ears. So if you think people hated the last Seinfeld.
Sopranos or whatever, yeah.
Just the man, oh, Marge is a rabbit. Oh, well, this was worth
this really
it.
Adds a layer of richness to the whole
they did
history.
A two-hour episode.
And Homer's Krusty. If you go back, you'll see.
Homer's Krusty. And then, you know, episode 3, Homer meets Krusty. Oh, well.
Oh, I'm wondering. So this is really, I guess, what I wonder deep down is if you guys ever think of these theories that you know aren't true or notice, I feel like your brains must notice patterns and think like, oh, I could pay that off in this way if I ever wanted to. For example, the idea that Homer, and even though Homer was not made to be identical to Krusty, he looks very much like him. And Bart, there's all this evidence that I won't actually break down because it's just hundreds and hundreds of pieces. But it's clear to me that the writers think of Bart as like a troubled kid who would otherwise achieve. Or at least when he actually is interested in anything, The look on your face makes it seem like you don't know you've been doing this, but exactly. anytime he sets his mind to
there's
anything,
a reason.
He's immediately
I'm thinking, great how do it. I let him down gently? It's come.
Bart has like this huge potential inside him that is not nurtured in the same way. There's all these family dynamics I'm projecting onto it, right? Yeah. Like Grandpa didn't treat Homer well. So Homer sort of ignores Bart, and he explicitly calls him his least favorite often. And Bart underachieves, but we see all these hints of like Bart becomes a takeout delivery boy. He's immediately as good as a ninja. Bart takes up courier service. He learns multiple foreign languages seemingly instantaneously.
Right.
Anything mm-hmm. he tries, he's great at. And I've just wondered, even if it wasn't the intent, did you guys ever think about like how sad and fucked up Bart is? Like he's like the child who's been neglected for 27 years.
Yes, and we made him Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
That's his saving grace, is that right. In the future he'll
and
be Matt fine.
And Matt freaked about that too. And it's pretty dumb too. Yeah. I remember Jeff saying 25 years ago, he's like, Bart is the hardest character to write. And we're just this. Do you remember that?
No, why did I say that?
Yeah, you why?
Said, well, what is he? Is he stupid or is he smart?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is he popular or is he picked
That's
out?
The other thing is he's interchangeably a loser, outcast, or the most popular kid in school.
Right.
I think he's most convincing as charismatic, like when he does the kids' news show.
Sure.
And he's instantly a hit, or he runs for school office and, you know, would seem to be the runaway favorite and that sort of thing. Because people forget, man, it was the Bart Show when it started.
Yeah. I had those t-shirts you guys were making fun of earlier, the I Carumbo with him surfing. I was 10 years old. I had that.
There was a little t-shirt controversy of the underachiever. You know, Bart sent an underachiever and he's saying, and proud of it, man.
Yeah.
And the Blue Noses were saying, that's a terrible message to send. And I got to say, that's one time I agreed with him. That's a terrible message.
It's like Kanye's Don't Go to College album. You're like, all right, it worked out for you. Calm down.
Yeah, that's right. No, yeah. Matt had sort of a tortured explanation. Like, well, they're putting labels on Bart, you see.
In the history of satire.
It's like, I don't know, Matt. I think he has something there.
I think Bart has been woefully underserviced by his community.
We don't know. He was always tough. None of the writers were Bart. In high school. They weren't the popular
So kid. No one intends a poignant dissection of how society creates bad kids. It's not.
No.
All right.
No. Okay. And most of us were Lisa. We're all Lisa.
I always saw a comic book guy.
Is that why Lisa has never had a friend in the history of
basically.
Easy to write. We all were Lisa, and then suddenly we're Homer. No transition. Well,
most of us, a lot of us knew each other in college.
Right.
And I look back at that and I think, like, we were so much like comic book guy. Just like watching TV and, you know, this is funny, that is not.
Yeah. It's so.
You know? And I'm just like, what, punk kids?
It's such a weird, like, disconnect that I have where I'm watching Simpsons and, like, going to diners with my friends and talking about theories about Simpsons and Futurama and movies and pop culture, then watching comic book guy. And like, what a funny different person from me. Like, I don't realize at all I'm 1,000% doing that.
I don't have a ponytail. And other differences, I'm sure. When the first Bob steps on a rake joke happened.
Yes.
Did you know?
No, I'm jumping in.
Okay, go ahead.
Confirm an anecdote that I've heard. This isn't a fan theory. This is I've heard on, I think, Everything's Coming Up podcast, an exclusively Simpsons podcast that is wonderful. I think that's where I heard
You're going there right after this, probably.
Yeah, that episode, the Cape Fear Sideshow Bob episode was short, and someone's suggestion to pad it was just add more rakes, and that's where that came from?
Exactly correct.
Yes.
I saw it happen. We had 7 seconds to fill, and Al Jean said, just show the rakes again. And it's just like Mary Poppins on there. Oh,
did it get you guys? Like, what? Did you guys think it was as hilarious as the audience did?
No. In
the one where Bart becomes Principal Skinner's Law and Order right-hand man, where they're opening the lockers trying to find the teacher's guide, was that Sam Simon going for the – they're like opening lockers, and it goes on so long – it stops being funny, and then it goes on even longer and starts being funny again.
Wow, I don't remember that.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I think Sam kind of had the courage to, you know.
You guys were probably tainted knowing that it was done out of necessity.
But I think that is universally one of the most beloved all-time jokes. Absolutely. And obviously it is because the people who were watching the show's early seasons when they were young and would grow up to write on The Simpsons include it constantly. I think it's the most recurring joke on the show is Sideshow Bob and the Rake.
It's a, you know, it's a risky joke to make to just keep going. And I've seen Family Guy go twice as long.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's the ante is up now.
Yes.
Can you waste people's time?
Family Guy has single-handedly pushed that envelope very far, pioneered the art of wasting your time in an episode.
I heard, if anyone wants the history, the first I've ever heard of a joke like that was Spike Milligan on British TV. He came out, good evening, everyone, and he got hit with a pie, and he cleans up. Good evening, everyone, and got hit with another pie, and it was something like 14 pies. They said that was the first time anyone's seen the phenomenon of, oh, come on. Oh, how long are they going to do this? Wow, they're really doing it. Yeah.
I just love studying the history of comedy basically just by watching comedies. And because you notice almost the evolution of ideas. You notice joke types get invented within the ecosystem of jokes and then proliferate and then like have their time in the sun and then become dated and fade away.
It's crazy. Like not even jokes, but how thoroughly Simpsons has impacted my idiolect, just like things that I say that I know I wouldn't have said, like I've like,
just
describing something as load-bearing is purely from that's a load-bearing poster, a load-bearing tack, whatever it was, like me using load-bearing, like I didn't pick that up from a book. There are just things that are like in my vocabulary and idiolect.
Idiocabulary?
Yeah, that's the one. Just from consuming that show so much.
You were speaking of Hans Molman earlier, who holds the distinction of being the most killed character on camera, if you don't count Itchy and Scratchy.
Okay.
Or I guess, I mean, Scratchy, if you don't count Scratchy. We are thinking of maybe doing a follow-up to that After Hours episode with additional theories. So I wanted to at least bring up the thing that we got really excited about in the room when we were brainstorming that idea, which is, have you guys ever talked about amongst yourselves... And there's Homer references. He drinks Barbicide in season 22, episode 20, and says, "Oh my God, why doesn't anything kill me?" And there's another episode where you show a flashback that seems to be canon because it's not a story, it's not a dream, it's a flashback. And the only character who's there, who's also there in present time, is Homer. And his name is Homer, and he's Homer. Everyone else is different because it's thousands of years ago, but Homer is there. Is Homer an immortal, godlike being? Like, why does the universe revolve around Homer?
I don't have an answer for you, though. I do remember George Meyer. He believed that a real key component of Homer's character was he realized he could not be killed.
Homer knows. Homer knows he can't be killed.
Yeah.
And John Swartzwelder said, who's written 60 episodes of the show, I said, "How do you write Homer?" He said, "The trick to writing Homer is to write him as a dog."
Like if a dog could talk.
Dog. Yeah, he's a talking dog. Always sort of peppy, happy, no short-term memory.
That's amazing. Yeah.
No worries. I really like, I want to talk about something because it's in that theory thing where you talk about, we call him Wise Guy. I don't know, it's this character.
Whoa, sure.
It's a voice that pops
I read in the Way Too Much Simpsons book or whatever that he was called Raphael. But that could have been like by some writer one time to someone.
It was so well observed. And then I go, Raphael, no.
He's Wise just, Guy.
So that's the thing. It's how how characters are created is almost always like Groundskeeper Willie or Apu. Mm. They come in with one line, and if it gets a laugh, we'll bring them back. And they come in with a line, the animators hear it, they draw a character that sounds like that voice, and then they'll slowly grow that way. But so the master of making something out of one line is Hank Azaria, and that's why at least half his characters still have no name. It's comic book guy, old Jewish man, wise guy. And we have the man who says yes. These are characters. And he had one episode where his line was, "Just stamp the ticket." That was the line. And it was so funny. That's a character on The Simpsons. Just stamp the ticket, man. So that's it. Wise Guy is a voice. He does a lot. And it's appeared in a lot of different – it comes out of a lot of different people.
Right. Well, he's even gotten to the point where there was an episode where – two wise guys interact with each other, like a valet and a parking attendant go like, how you doing, buddy? You just pushed it, pal. Which is another one of our theories is, and I'd ask it, if not literally, because obviously you guys are going to crush every dream and there's no real theories. But from a creative standpoint, what's with the obsession with clones? Because everyone in The Simpsons has many, many, many multiple versions of themselves in Shelbyville in various episodes. But I mean, like, if you do what I do and watch the whole series only thinking about this, it's inescapable that everyone has not multiple doppelgangers, including versions of people who look like failed clones of them. Yeah. Even down to minor characters will meet doppelgangers of theirs. And do you have, I'm asking if you can maybe introspect, because I know there's not like a plot reason, but why are doppelgangers so funny?
Michael, read the room. They don't care.
They don't know.
Did you ask what it was like to meet Johnny Carson?
What's so funny about Homer running into Guy Incognito and everyone having like an exact duplicate? What is with the obsession? There's no answer.
It's creative laziness.
Good. Well, this was my gotcha question, so yeah. We can move on. Good.
What was it like to meet Johnny Carson?
Yeah.
Most charming man I ever met.
Did he ask a lot of the questions that we've asked?
I heard comic book guy was named Lewis Lane informally.
No.
Lewis Lane,
who's
no.
coming up with these names?
Never heard
disseminating
that.
Them to
never
me.
Heard
always
that.
Comic book guy, and he's someone people. There'd been at least when he first came out, there were so many theories. Oh, he's based on this guy, and somebody said, oh, he's Ralph Bakshi, and that's how Ralph Bakshi talks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a perfect composite of a lot of guys you see at comic book conventions, which we all go to, and the animators go to, and. Go to Comic-Con, you'll see 15 comic book guys walking around. And one night, it was one of the rare nights we got off early-ish at The Simpsons, and there's a comic book store, or there was, right next to Fox Studios.
Mm-hmm.
And I walk in, and sitting by the counter is comic book guy. There he is, 10 feet away from our offices working there. He's just
a guy that exists,
type.
Yeah.
I just want to say, it's not the least bit off-putting that you've concocted theories.
Oh, good.
No, it's really flattering. It's fantastic somebody cares that much and enjoyed it that much.
I was going for oppressively creepy, but I'll take flattery.
So worried that you're going to go back to the Simpsons palace.
And be like, we
made a mistake.
Guys.
We did something wrong.
We're pumping out a generation of weirdos.
No, it's nice. You're giving us too much credit.
Yeah.
That's all, but it's flattering.
There's a web archive, I don't know what it's called, of scholarly papers on The Simpsons.
Yes.
Hundreds of them. And so I went there. I said, I'm going to start reading this. And I read it. I read the first one. I go, wrong. The second one, wrong. And then I said, I'm just going to read these till they make a mistake and I'll move on. And I went through like 50 in an hour. It was just by paragraph two, they're just saying something that's not true. Almost always showing intentionality or planning. Just don't do that. You know, I'll tell one more story because I forget this one.
Sure.
It was season one, before you were even there. We were pitching an episode, Homer dies. We were just going to kill Homer halfway through the episode. There'd be a funny but sad funeral.
Yeah.
Marge would start dating by the end of the episode. And then next week, Homer would be back.
Oh,
we just, so and that was
the Kenny joke.
The extent to which we didn't care, you know, when we thought nobody would care.
So speaking of, the scholarly aspects and giving you way too much credit, what's the nerdiest, I guess, rules of comedy argument you've ever gotten into? Because I got in a long discussion about, there's a joke in season 22, that tick sure done swelled you up, normal head Joe, Cletus is saying to his son who has a large head. I think in reference to someone having to eat something as large as a baby's head. There's so many levels nestled within it, that joke, that require your knowledge that you're in a fabricated space, that I had an argument with someone about whether it qualifies as Brechtian or not. And I'm just wondering,
do you
guys ever give yourselves that much credit? Like, do you ever sit across the desk and be like,
this is, works because of Aristotle's three fundamental truths, or is it just what makes you laugh in the room?
You know what that makes me think of is it's like that sounds like the sort of arguments they'd have on the show Studio 60. Remember that? Sure, on the Sunset Strip. Yes.
Matthew Perry.
Yes, and I remember they're watching that and they're just righteous as all get out, just like we picked the wrong satirical target for that sketch.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
Pimp my trike is ironclad.
And you know, I would just watch that show just like shaking my head like, not a second of this is accurate.
You wouldn't last a second in a writer's room talking like that.
No, that's the thing. And 30 Rock, which doesn't even really try to take it seriously.
Right. No.
And just every now and then.
Shows the writer's room as a backdrop.
Yeah, and every now and then in the background, there'll be like a couple of robots boxing or something like that.
Yeah.
And you won't even see what the sketch is. And I thought that's much, much closer to the reality.
Yeah, things are more casual than imagined. I've often heard Scrubs as the most realistic depiction of like working at a hospital.
Yeah.
Because it's nothing much spectacular happens.
Just people fucking around. And
A cop asked me once. He said, "Do you have cops working on The Simpsons?" I go, "No." He says, "You must, because Chief Wiggum is so real to life."
He only has three attributes, and they're all bad. I don't want my cops to have them.
Yeah. Chief Wiggum is dumber than Homer.
Yes.
I mean, it's like, wow, really?
And one of the only characters who can rival Homer for idiocy.
Just an existential fear that this conversation brings out in me that I think I've mentioned before. Our generation, Michael's and mine, were terrible because of the amount of access that we have. Because
and analysis.
Like, because like even when I was younger, pre-internet, there was like value in staying up late and being there for Saturday Night Live or a Comedy Central special or whatever it was, or like value in having a dad that had comedy records. And now everything is everywhere. You can listen to Marc Maron talk to Gary Shandling. It's a free podcast. You could just do that. And it created a generation of people like us who are like, all of comedy has lots of rules and structure that we can follow. Like, we get into arguments when we're writing something, and it's like, no, it doesn't work because it's not Brechtian enough or whatever your rules are. And I worry that that will be creatively stifling or is creatively stifling.
No, I'm a classicist. I want less Brechtian.
Right.
You always do this.
I worry about stifling, but especially when I hear from the greats, as you guys said you were earlier. Because you guys really are just like free and fun and making each other laugh in a room. And that needs to be the only rule, Michael.
I guess. I guess we better rewrite all the series we have in the works.
No,
because I had no fun working on them.
I don't know if other shows are like this, but people ask if we were writing with the audience in mind, and I gotta say we really were just writing for each other.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just trying to get a laugh in the room.
Monty Python famously had no ratings feedback for like the first 6 episodes. And then just found out that they were huge.
Right.
It's got to be nice.
I don't have a theory attached to it, but what you said about staying up late to see the comedy, that really was a part of it.
Yeah.
In the 70s. And I wrote for Letterman all through the 80s is what I was doing. And I was just always astounded how quickly, if you did a bit on the show, we wrote one where we were comparing Letterman's hair to a hamster. We were calling him Hamster Head, his current haircut at the time. And a couple of days later, we won an Emmy. and we're like walking, making the rounds with the press and walking by, and there's the fans, and people are yelling Hamster Head. And it's just like, you had to be awake at 1 a.m. to hear that.
Yeah,
there was no other way.
You did not Hulu that on your phone on the train ride.
No.
That's cool.
Are you too close to have favorite episodes and favorite jokes?
Oh, definitely I do.
Yeah. I'm not really a fan of the show.
You an American Dad guy? I can see it.
Well, I mean, you know, I have hundreds, thousands of jokes I love. I like every now and then they'll really pop a real transgressive one. Homer filling out a questionnaire, ask him his religion, and Homer goes, "What's that one with all the well-meaning rules that don't work out in real life? Christianity."
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you're just like, "Whoa!" Or another one like that. Marge is lecturing, saying to the kids, "Marriage is a wonderful thing. but it's also a constant struggle for moral superiority. just these, and a lot of people's favorite, one of their favorites was, the Swartzwelder line, I think, was to alcohol, the cause of and solution to all life's problems.
I'm certain there are people who quote that don't even realize it's Simpsons. Like, there are people who are just like, that's one, like, I think, guys. Ben Franklin probably.
I think I got to find this for, like, the huge, very dark, clear-eyed looks into the abyss.
You pitched the line once we didn't use, but killed me, right, where Smithers, for some reason, said something about religion to Mr. Burns, and Mr. Burns goes, well, being a thinking man, I don't believe in God.
It's pretty straightforward.
Didn't go in. No. Guy can't catch a break.
On the same note, do you guys have favorite plot lines or hooks or characters to center around? Like, there's the classic, Lisa is outraged by something and takes a stand against it. There's the subtler one, which I just picked up by chugging the show a lot in preparation for this and the episode of After Hours, was Marge feels the pressure to conform to something society wants and then realizes that she can find strength in her family. There's, like, plots that have recurred and that sort of flow naturally out of the characters and the family that you've set up. Are there ones that you liked writing? Or is there, like, rather than a joke, right, like an episode or a story,
like the Lisa
idea
and Bart team ups, like, yeah, we need to,
yeah,
solve some,
or Lisa and Bart team, yeah, up to solve a problem. Yeah, that's a good one.
if it's strictly we need to stick a character in a scene just to answer your question, my favorites are Bumblebee Man and Old Gil.
Old Gil
for no cosmic, just simply because
took
they
me a long time
up
to realize it was Jack Lemmon Glengarry.
You know, I mean, in terms of favorite episodes, I really like Bart the General because I'd been hired by the show. And we'd like sold our place in New York and I'd left, you know, quit Letterman and I was going to move out there. And that was like the third or fourth one to air. And I'm like watching it and I'm going to get on a plane later that week. And I just thought it was so great that I realized, oh boy, I'm Ringo here. I'm hopping on to, you know.
You're too excited for a job and you're like, maybe I shouldn't. Yeah.
Right. Let's see. Soon after I got there, they did the episode where Marge almost had the affair with the bowler, you know, and I just thought.
Okay,
it was
so she's been contemplating infidelity since way back.
Season one. I mean, she left her prom date to be with Homer. If you cheat, if she cheats with you, she'll cheat on you. Like, that's
another thing that you guys obviously don't write anything with any sort of intention or broader vision, but something that might interest you.
30 Rock. It's like 30 Rock.
Marge's problem in episodes where the problem is that she feels lesser than because of a societal thing is always solved by her serendipitously, without dialogue, seeing a sequence of symbolic things.
You are correct.
Has that been noticed before?
I knew if the podcast would go long enough, you'd get something right.
Yeah.
And this is it. Yeah, I mean, you might call these hacky. We do all the time that I can't stand, but who can resist it? Homer becomes a tennis pro. Oh, he's suddenly good at tennis, and then Pete Sampras, world-famous tennis player, what are you doing in Springfield? Well, blah, blah, blah. He gives advice, and I just can't stand it. Homer gets in a profession. We get the most famous guy in the world in that profession to give Homer some advice at the end.
No, but you've refreshed it so many ways.
That was undercut with the Joe Namath.
Joe Namath, that's where I was going.
Where it's like, Bart Nee, oh, I'll never be a good quarterback. Excuse me, son, I'm Joe Namath.
Remember what Joe Namath.
And he just wants directions or something. No,
it's remember what Joe Namath told you, and it's that the car's fine, it was just vapor lock.
Vapor lock.
We were just talking about a funny one yesterday where Joe Frazier was going to, the boxing champ, was going to be on the show, and he was going to get in a fight with Barney, and the comedy thing you always do, and we wrote it too, is Barney winds up beating the crap out of Joe Frazier.
Lord Palmerston.
And we sent it to Joe Frazier, and his son and manager Marvis Frazier said, Dad's not going to want to get beat up. So we just flipped the joke and had Joe Frazier beat the crap out of this poor drunk, leave him broken.
I actually love that bit because, there's no reason for Barney to pick a fight.
Right.
Yeah. It's like Sting and Groundskeeper. He's chatting with Homer and Barney goes, hey, Frazier, shut up.
My favorite undercutting of that, though, is I forget which boxer is the greeter at the Burns Casino, but Barney sucker punches him once in the jaw, and he just goes down immediately.
Jerry Cooney?
I think it was Jerry
Cooney. Oh, that sounds right.
You hear great stories getting these celebrities sometimes. It's like, we want Jerry Cooney on the show. How do we reach him? And they said, well, he has no phone.
Oh, my God.
How do we get to call, like, the mayor of the town he lives in to go to Jerry Cooney's house? And there's one – I think I can tell this story now. I may get in trouble. But
good. Go for it.
We were writing an episode, and we needed a celebrity. That was it. We couldn't narrow it down.
That's the credentials.
Any famous person was to be a judge of a thing, and we need a celebrity. And we pay our celebrities scale, $400 to do it. And we couldn't think – we're fighting. Who could it be? And the casting woman comes in and said, Little Richard, the rock star, Little Richard – owes Fox $400. So we go, and we didn't ask why or how. We go, all right, he's going to work off his debt. And that's how Little Richard became the judge of the National Spelling Bee.
Amazing.
Mike, do you have a favorite episode?
You know, I've worked on the show for 26 of the 28 years. So the 2 years I didn't work there, I get to go home and watch The Simpsons. And those are the best years to me. Clearly, I've been dragging the product down all the years. But people go, why isn't the show as good as it used to be? It's my fault. So there's a Halloween show I didn't work on where there's, I think it takes place in a tub of butter or something, or a tooth. Something like that. That one's so awesome. My favorite episode, one I had nothing to do with, where Lisa finds the bones of an angel.
It's great,
and it's about, again, theology and belief and that kind of thing. And that one I thought was really fantastic.
No, I thought the one where they did the parody of the variety show, the Simpsons Variety Hour.
Wonderful,
It's just note perfect. Yeah. It's a beautiful job. Showcase. They did a beautiful job with that. And it was also dear to us because we had this tape of the Brady Bunch Variety Hour somehow, you know, a big cassette of their failed spinoff variety show. And we'd like watch – we'd eat lunch and watch like 7 minutes.
At a time.
In drips and drabs. And that was our little treat.
Do you guys have anything else you
want to – I'm on a huge high because he said one of my things was right.
No,
because I need to undercut it because it is the Simpsons way to undercut any positive moment. I'll ask about the hair or just is there any intentionality behind the fact that in the whole Simpsons universe, everyone has relatively normal hair and then the Simpsons family – have these bizarre hair that melds with their heads. Was the idea to make them really recognizable and iconic just by outline, or is it just what Matt happened to draw? And have you guys ever talked about why only them? Like, no one else in the world has hair that melds immediately to their forehead.
Yeah, well, it was just them. It's funny, you know, I do a lot of college speaking, and I do Q&A, and I never hear a question I haven't heard 10,000 times. And then one week, it was like a six-year-old kid said, why are they yellow? And I go, I have no idea. And I went to work, and nobody knew why they were yellow, or nobody thought to even ask it. And it is because Matt just drew these outlines, and their hair merges into their skin with no border.
Right.
So it's this poor woman. It was a colorist who worked at the animation company, just said, I'll make them yellow, that sort of hair, that sort of skin. And it's this
she had to compromise between skin and hair.
That's why they're yellow.
And they're yellow.
It's this unheralded Hungarian woman who worked at the animation studio, gave Marge blue hair and the green dress, all this stuff that's very iconic. Yeah. It was just some lady working at it and the rest of us going, all right, sure.
There was so much apocrypha. I was always told that Matt Groening wanted it to be yellow because it amused him to think of people adjusting the color on their TV set during the first episode. But no.
Nope.
Great. It's busted.
Nope.
You got a closer?
I do. I don't have a closer. I had a personal vow that I wasn't going to be the one who brought up Critic, but if it came up, I would talk about it. I love that show so much.
I think that's nice.
Every bit of it. It's one of my favorite shows. The theme song is like modern Gershwin, amazing piece of music. And yeah, I really like that show.
The painting on the backgrounds is beautiful. Yeah. It's a masterpiece.
Oh, I feel like it.
It's great.
We're all these people when we were actually on the air.
I was watching it on the air. But
and people always tell me, because
believe it or not, it wasn't enough.
I just made this joke, but I can say in reality, I'm not a fan of The Critic. I created it and worked on it and wrote them, but I don't like the show.
Oh, yeah?
Because it didn't
You keep
hit.
Finding ways to hurt me today.
Yeah, this is the hardest part of the podcast
so far.
You know,
it was never what The Simpsons was. And I don't mean popular, but depth of character and intricate plotting. It's just jokes, and they're funny jokes. But people will come up to me, you know, it's 20 years old. They go, it's still fresh. It's still timely.
I mean,
it's like,
sorry, it is, man. Whether you know it or not.
First thing you see in The Critic, title card, there's the World Trade Center.
Yeah,
you in the mood for fresh comedy?
But that you keep biscuits in your pocket joke will never, ever not be timely. I don't care. Dan, shut this fool down. The Critic is amazing.
Well, Mike at one point used to answer the question. His favorite episode was the substitute teacher episode.
Oh, yeah. He said,
you know, that's a special one. Well, yeah. John Vitti wrote the script, but Jim Brooks, we were having one of those story retreats and the idea for a substitute teacher, and I got to hand it to Brooks because he just said, oh, let's see, and he has to go to another school, and Lisa's running by the train. He gives her a piece of paper, and he opens it, and it says, "You're Lisa Simpson." And I got to say, the rest of us, all of us were kind of like, hey, man, I don't know, okay.
Was that the first special episode?
Season, there's like moaning Lisa, and there's some touching moments in those early ones. But that was just one where, you know, and when it did all come together and come back, you know, I do remember Mike shaking his head and saying, like, Brooks knows more about how to touch an audience.
Now on that,
all of us put together, you know. So
was there an intentional heartbreaking symmetry? Because that always choked me up. The "You Are Lisa Simpson" made me feel great. And then fast forward a few seasons later, when they go to Ned's beach house and she leaves saying "Bye bye, Lisa Simpson," that I always took as a callback to the substitute teacher episode, and it destroyed me. There's nothing there. There's no connection there.
I don't think so.
Okay, so
that I always read that as a rejection of that mantra that she'd sort of been given by Bergstrom, and it made me sad. But if it's not true, then everything's okay.
This will probably sound really silly to you guys, but yeah, I also wept the first time I saw the "You Are Lisa Simpson."
Yeah, really. It hit me. Because he wrote it down. Jim Brooks. We were all sitting in his office. He wrote it on a piece of paper and handed it around, and we each get this piece of paper that says, "You are Lisa Simpson."
Like, I am?
And I go, yeah, I thought it was like charades or something. Yeah. None of us got it. None of us understood what it was.
But yeah, those Brooks lines, they had a certain. Yeah. And Mike came into the office one day and said, "I thought of the greatest Jim Brooks line." And it was, he says, "You know what I hate? I hate the part of me that doesn't love you enough." See, now that, yeah.
He should be writing plays.
And we all kind of went like, okay. Yeah.
Don't put that in the episode. I'm going to go home and tell my wife that.
Also, that episode set up for, I think, the hardest I laughed in the most recent season, which is Marge saying, I think Lisa's in the basement. Marge says, "Come up for dinner soon. Someone who loves you is cutting your meat." And it cuts up and Bergstrom is silently there. Oh, okay. And she goes, "Don't worry, Mr. Bergstrom. I'll tell Lisa you drop by." But also, just for the listening audience, I did want to point out something that a fan very graciously brought up to me, which is a really touching episode in the recent canon that I think people should give a second look or watch if they haven't sought it out, is called "A Really Fun Thing Bart Will Never Do Again," where he goes on the cruise and has the existential crisis of how in life any dopamine you you receive is eventually going to fade. And that one really got me. That was very touching from the recent era.
That was a really good
one. That was a great one.
Matt Warburton wrote that one.
And I would laud Apatow's decision to make Homer stop strangling Bart. That does seem a little like the more past the year 2000 we get that Homer's still strangles Bart. It's a cartoon.
A lot of things are more palatable in cartoon form.
Right, it's true. That,
the classic example of something clearly horrifying.
Yeah.
In that same spin-off showcase. No, it was a look back, another John Vitti episode where they showed him strangling
inventing
and
it.
Troy McClure goes like, "That horrifying bit of child abuse became a beloved, you know,
running joke."
Running joke.
I said it must be, cause the nigga got dough. Extraordinary swag in the mouth full of gold. Hoes at my shows, they be stripping off their clothes. And the college girls write a nigga name on their toe. Niggas talk shit till they get locked jaw. Chrome till you don't, till you get Glock jaw. Party like a cowboy or a rock star. Everybody play the tough guy to shit pop off.
Let's take it to the basis. You and them miss the greatness.
All right, that was our episode. This is Goldie by ASAP Rocky about having yellow teeth from coffee stains, I think, is what it's about when he talks about having a mouth full of gold, right? That can't mean anything else. We're going to ride out on a different song, Favorite by Nico Case, off her 2004 live album, The Tigers Have Spoken, which is a beautiful song that talks about picking favorites, so appropriate to how we ended the conversation, and about thinking someone's golden, which, yes, ties to our overall theme of yellow people being yellow. I did it, you guys. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Hope you enjoyed it, learned something. On to footnotes. We have two links in our footnotes section in the description of the episode. Wherever you are listening to this, you can go to the description and find our footnotes section. And yeah, just two links, but maybe our greatest footnotes section ever. So one is a link to a list of all the scholarly articles about The Simpsons that Mike was talking about. Just on the first page, you have How Time Works and The Simpsons, Teaching Sociology Seminars Through The Simpsons, : Homer Under C. Wright Mills's Eye, one called Lisa Simpson as the Voice of Double-Coded Critiques of Contemporary Society, another called Intermedial Dickensian References in the TV Show The Simpsons. Those are all on page one. I didn't make it far beyond page one because our other link is every episode of The Simpsons ever at SimpsonsWorld.com. So I went and watched the monorail episode rather than thinking of some lessons we all learned today. By the way, my favorite joke in the history of The Simpsons is from season 12, episode 7, called The Great Money Caper. That's sort of a The Sting, Paper Moon ripoff. Not my favorite episode, but my favorite joke. Basically, Bart and Homer become a team of grifters, and it ends with a giant Sting-like prank. It takes too much explaining. If you ever watch the episode, my favorite joke is the last thing Groundskeeper Willie says in the courtroom. Anyways, thanks to Engineer Brett, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. Also, thanks to Engineer Brett at Earwolf, other Engineer Brett. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien. I'm going to go watch that episode I just talked about. And we'll be back next week with more podcast. Talk to you then. Love.
I'm Sarah Thayer.
And I'm Susan Orlean. And nothing makes us happier than hearing what makes people cry.
On our show, Cry Babies, we talk to comedians, musicians, writers, and other awesome people about what makes them cry. And sometimes we cry too.
But it's the good kind of crying.
Yeah.
Therapeutic.
Yeah.
Like when Drew Drogi told us what he loves Dead Poets Society.
When it came out, I loved English. I wanted to be an English teacher. I was obsessed with that whole world, and boys' boarding school. I thought that just looked so amazing. Also, like, Robert Sean Leonard was, like, an actor, and, you know, and I just thought that was such a fabulous thing to be.
So, listen to Cry Babies. Find us on Earwolf, Howl, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.